Hi everyone. Welcome to the last week of September. I'm recording this on Sunday the 24th, and I'll post it tomorrow on Monday sometime after it's edited. And as you know, our plan is to begin the series on the Grail, and particularly emphasizing the feminine figures in those myths and legends.
My podcast is imperfect, because I'm always learning as I'm going. But the one thing I am always offering you is a servant's heart, for sure. And that I am seeking to metabolize the material that I'm presenting. So it is my intention that that is coming through. And I think that it does. When I hear folks react to it or comment on it, it seems that that's the case, and I'm so grateful for that. But you just don't kind of take lightly a dive into the Grail. And I just have to laugh at myself, because my heart is what said, do this. And I'm doing it with great abandon. And it's just a massive, massive, yet exceedingly simple topic. You know, and I guess I just say that by articulating straight away that we are in the land of paradox right away. My notes won't even be pinned down. Like, I spent an hour before I got in front of the mic here today, this Sunday afternoon. I've been collecting things and sort of finding my way through to give some kind of situational relevance as we open up this massive topic. But my notes themselves just simply don't want to be pinned down. It's almost like the material itself is so hot, if you will. You know, it's so charged, it's so beautiful, it's so ethereal, it's so substantive, but yet shimmery, that it's almost playing a bit of hide and seek with me, and we're just going to have to approach it that way. And I imagine you'll listen to it that way, and it's going to do that dance with you too. So we're kind of along for the ride, although we're in exquisite hands, I would definitely say. We're in the hands of life. And the message is just so wondrous and so shimmering and so important, particularly now. Particularly now with all the conflict in the external world. And we'll hear that with the passages I'm reading, that the Grail becomes more relevant at different points in history. And it's definitely relevant now. And here my heart was saying, which again is like the intelligence center par excellence. You know, it's not just this cheeky, sentimental notion of following a particular topic. There was a resonance that said, do this. And definitely exploring the feminine aspect of this legend as well. And that was kind of even a new idea to me. Like, okay. And I think I had just, what maybe spurred that, or perhaps came immediately after, I can't even remember the order of events, but I had seen this book called The Ladies of the Lake. And we all have probably heard of the Lady of the Lake, and she is the incredible mystical figure who holds Excalibur up out of the lake for Arthur to take and use in all of his quests and undertakings. But this book by Kathleen Matthews is called The Ladies, plural, of the Lake. And I think that was in part an inspiration. And I'll get to that later today in our discussion, talk more about that. But this whole topic of King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table, the quest for the Grail, these myths and legends are part of our beautiful Western wisdom tradition, of which we don't have a whole lot of. We often borrow from the Eastern traditions. And in fact, you know, if you've been listening to the podcast recently, I've been reading from Autobiography of a Yogi. So, you know, we've been reading from more the Eastern perspective on the mystical traditions, but this uniquely belongs to the West. And so it's wonderful to embrace that aspect of it. And it's also worth noting here straight away that when we enter the realm of myth and legend, I want you to imagine a horizontal axis and a vertical axis. Our ego timeline has a past, present, future. It's the horizontal axis. That is the axis of your personality, of all of your stories, of the culture, all of those things, all of the dramas, all of the external world that exists on the horizontal axis. When we dive into myth and legend, when we dive into the present moment, when we have mystical experience, or as you've heard me say several podcasts running now, level 3 consciousness, see parts passing, if that's new to you, we talk a lot about levels 1, 2, 3, and 4 consciousness, which we will definitely be referring to today. So level 3, those mystical peak experiences that sort of find us, that we don't perhaps have any idea how we are visited by them. They just sort of happen and we enjoy them and are changed for them having moved through us. But we kind of didn't, you know it was coming. When those sorts of things happen, when those sorts of experiences, when that paradoxical story time enters the psyche and we enter it, we are now on a vertical axis. And that exists outside of space and time. And I really want to emphasize that it exists outside of space and time, and it is ever renewing itself. If you are remembering a dream, the dream life would also exist on the vertical axis. If you are remembering a dream that you had 20 years ago, it's on your vertical axis. It's still offering something to you. It is still relevant. It might be relevant today in a completely new way than it was when you had it. So, story, myth, legend, paradox, dreams, level 3 and 4 experiences in terms of consciousness, these all are the vertical axis. And they're, it's lovely to think of that as the present moment. That's where all of our power is, 100%. That is where the essential self resides. That is where the authentic self resides. That is where God, Goddess, the supreme consciousness, however you want to think of that, the quantum field, access point, vertical axis. And I like thinking of that just shooting straight up through the heart and along the spine and into the meta mind, not just the ego mind, but the meta beyond mind. So this is where we enter the realm of the fantastical, which is actually the most real thing. It is the most real thing. It's not from the perspective of the external world. You know, it's often discarded, but that's where the juice is. That's where the vitality is. That's where the wisdom is. That's where the joy is. So we are entering that space in this series and with the writings I will share today. And indeed, this entire quest for the Grail is along that vertical axis. It has literally nothing to do with the horizontal axis, other than, you know, you'll hear plot points that would seemingly exist in time, but this myth is so beyond the bounds of time. It's ever new, it's ever green, it's ever present. And it's definitely vibrating in a palpable sense right now with where we are on the human timeline. So where those points are intersecting right now, it's hugely relevant right now, which obviously is in part why I wanted to dive into it. And I'm seeking to integrate this into my own life because, as you know, for the past several months, we've been undertaking the very, I would offer, masculine discipline of calling into account and holding ourselves accountable for how we're processing the external world, how we are training our imagination, how we are reacting or non-reacting with all of the exercises and transurfing material, et cetera, levels of consciousness that we've been talking about. I feel largely and broadly speaking, as I look at it now, that has been a very masculine container that we have been exercising and strengthening. And to great effect in my life, I must say, I feel like I've done more growing in the past two and a half months, 3 months than I have my entire life. So it's exhilarating. And that discipline has incredible fruit just in my sense of being right now. I just feel more authentic and more from a seat of power and sovereignty. And I don't mean that with any kind of arrogance, because that belongs to all of us. I just feel that, and it's so comforting, it's so beautiful, it's so self-sustaining. But that's not the end of the story, and I'm realizing that, and that's what September in particular has been about for me, and why you're just hearing from me now the last week of September. Because that masculine discipline, as I'm coming to understand it, is exquisitely holding a feminine center. And Jung often said that the anima is the archetype of life itself, or, you know, the closest to it. That doesn't have anything to do with man, woman, okay? It's the masculine and feminine energies within all of us. But that receptive beingness, as opposed to the masculine action-centered solidity and strength and outward-moving energy, the vivacity, the vibrancy of life herself is at the core of what these masculine practices have been honoring, defending, protecting, so that she may dance and flourish and be in delight. So again, hindsight becomes 2020 as I see what's actually happening, looking back a little bit through the month, is this interest to do a series on the Grail is actually happening internally as well as externally on the podcast, because this beautiful discipline of the masculine is arriving at this center where it is her with a capital H, life with a capital L, self with a capital S, essence. And it is very much a beingness. And I would offer, you know, here's the end of the Grail series right now. This is definitely a level 4 perspective, but this is the Grail. This is the Grail. This exquisite feminine center that is the closest we can conceptualize to the ultimate divine from a human perspective. And it is this mystical centeredness of being that is then surrounded by this strong and masculine container of how to perceive and use the mind properly and the imagination. But she at her center is pure delight, pure being, pure ever new generation of life, life itself. And as we come to that center that exists in every single one of us. And when we are in touch with that, everything changes externally. We're almost beyond words here. Only poetry, certain poetry, can even touch the sublime nature of that. And so I'm seeing that these challenges of my past several months and the masculine container that I've been driven to embrace, to understand, and hold my center is delivering me to this exquisite, tender, but yet powerful center of pure delight and pure joy and pure being. And, you know, the Gnostics would call that the Sophia image. It's kind of beyond words, but the fact that I had this seed of an idea to explore the grail from the feminine perspective, now I'm starting to see why. You know, I'm like, okay, I'll do that. And now I'm starting to see why. So that always happens. You know, I'm like, okay. And I take several steps and then I'm like, okay, I guess I see why that's happening now. I'm learning to live that way. I have a lot of practice. So anyway, I'm trusting that more and more and more by the minute. But this container revealing this precious center is sort of where we begin today. And that's when I define level 4 grail as you, as me, but us without any of the filters, without any of the perceptions of fear or anything but love. And the unity consciousness being the grail itself. So if you look at the grail from level 2 or level 1, you're going to define it very differently. And they all have an appropriate place and trajectory of the journey and gifts to offer, however we define it. Like, for example, the grail in level 2, where we're a lot about psychology and taking agency and work ethic, etc. That's where a lot of our institutions dwell, and our academic institutions and our religious institutions. I think the conversation of, quote, the grail in that frame of consciousness is often an actual chalice or cup that, you know, is legend to be, you know, from the Last Supper or from the Christ story. So an actual cup. And then you get at the edges of that consciousness, and that's where you have mythos around it being an actual bloodline of the Christ figure. And maybe there's a feminine aspect to that, like the Christ bloodline going into the future, or Mary Magdalene, or images like that. You know, again, moving into a different level of consciousness, the grail sort of reinvents itself. But for our purposes here, I think all of us are very much about level 4, level 3 and level 4. And the grail is you and the grail is me, and touching that precious center and seeing how then that changes the external world, because it has to, because the external world is mirroring who we are, who we identify ourselves to be. And so, my God, you're going to have an incredible external world if you are in touch with that most exquisite center, because it has to mirror your wealth. It has to mirror your inner marriage to self. It has to mirror your creativity and joy. So that is one incredible vision for what life can be like. So these are my thoughts as we enter into this material. This is all a way of discovering that precious center that is with us all the time, that we have often traveled our whole lives up until this moment searching for, and it's been with us the whole time. And yet, I see that although today my intention is to situate the Grail story sort of historically in terms of how it has been written about and talked about and perceived in terms of the characters and the symbolism, but largely there's a feminine angel, if you will, a feminine presence over this entire discussion. And I didn't know why, you know, other than, okay, here's this book about the Grail women and the ladies of the lake. And, you know, just I had these seemingly disparate pieces coming together. And then I'm suddenly like in the last few days, I'm like, oh, I see this is really powerful. You know, I'm feeling that joy emanating from my center, a joy I wouldn't even have accessed if not for suffering and pain and incredible challenge. And then responding to that with those masculine disciplines. And so it feels like a redemptive move on the part of the psyche to say all of that work was not in vain. It's actually revealing more and more and more. And that's a beautiful thing about the vertical axis of our life, is it's never satiated, but in a positive, healthy way, we keep uncovering mysteries and beauty. Whereas the horizontal axis, if you keep going to its outer edges, trying to only satiate in the external world, it becomes very harmful, very destructive, very quickly. But that insatiable curiosity and desire of the heart, as long as you are accessing that from the vertical axis of your life, it's ever giving. It's a fountain that will never run dry. So these are all images and fragments of the veil and of the Grail. So we're going to dive in as best we can with something that's very much not going to be pinned down. And that is definitely a quality of the feminine with a capital F. She will not be pinned down. She will not. And that is as it should be. So that's my grand introduction today. And I imagine what will happen is, since we're only doing one podcast here in September, because this was kind of this was kind of a surprise and a big one for me, then in October I imagine that I'll do three, and we'll be focusing on a female figure in each of those and seeing where that takes us. So we will get back in our rhythm, you know, with the number of podcasts I like to release in a year's time. But this is just how it is right now, because this was so much larger than I anticipated. But it's so fruitful, and I'm hoping that you will be benefiting and enjoying and communing with the material as I am. And I know that you will be. So I hope you're doing well. The full harvest moon will be Friday of this week coming up. And that's always a special time, because we are officially in the Northern Hemisphere in the season of autumn. We just had the autumnal equinox. I absolutely love this time of year. It is my favorite season. And I'm just reveling in the external beauty of nature, but also just this growing sense of possibility and abundance and things coming to fruition in my own heart. And I hope that you are having a sense of that yourself. And the harvest moon is a beautiful time to connect with those abundant blessings and that sense of being cared for and being cherished by the divine, which is you, which is me.
So I'm not going to share a poem per se today, like I typically do at the beginning, just because I have such a wealth of material that I'll be reading from and sharing today, and we're definitely going to be in that beautiful vertical space and that consciousness of 3 and 4. So we're going to have a lot of that today. So I just didn't want to do it for the sake of checking a box, because there's going to be a lot of rich reading and sharing today. So one concept I want to begin with is, a lot of times when you hear of the King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table legends, you will hear the phrase, the once and future king. And I love that, because obviously we're going to hear a story about these amazing figures. And again, from our depth psychological perspective, the characters and the archetypes and the journeys in story and in dream are all interior figures in each of us. So we relate to them in that way. We all have a King Arthur. We all have a Lady of the Lake. We all have an Excalibur, et cetera, et cetera. We all are the Grail. So we will approach these figures and archetypes and myths from that perspective. But this idea of the once and future king fits right in with that archetypal idea. And although we may not explicitly be encountering in the literature the once and future queen, I want to insert that right here, right now, because that matters. And it's true. And again, that fits under this larger umbrella of the feminine perspective into this material as well. The masculine and the feminine perspectives are so vital to the conversation about the Grail. And I've already hinted at one way that that's true. Just the idea of all we've been doing with our transurfing and our imaginal work and our non-reaction and just all the disciplines we've been doing and the alchemical points and holding steady with the imagination and all of this rich, rich work we've been doing has required a focus and a discipline that's very masculine in its energy. And you could so liken that to the knights of the Round Table, who are going out in pursuit of and protecting this most exquisite discovery of the eternal and of the eternal feminine, however shape it's taking with whatever story you're encountering. And we'll get more into that here in just a minute. So I love this sense of the once and future king, meaning there are masculine ideas that are presented in the material that we will then be embodying for ourselves. But also I want to bring in this idea of the once and future queen. We knew this part of ourselves before we came into the world, and we will know her again. And there can be no greater joy than that. And again, I'm talking about as close as the human language can get to the archetype of life of the divine itself, as the her, as the she. So, you know, because once you get past that, there are no words. This is an entirely experiential pursuit and receiving of the divine. That dance between seeking and finding is such a tension in this material. And I ran across beautiful phrases throughout, you know, the past month, just putting this material together. There is a part of one of the Psalms that says, depth seeks depth. And I loved that, because if you're thinking of the vertical axis of the present moment, of our connection to the authentic self, the depth in us in terms of our personality, in terms of our understanding and growing consciousness is seeking us. And so the deep part of our personal nature is seeking depth itself. And I love also that that which you're seeking is seeking you. And so the authentic divine is calling out for us to this inner marriage of the personality, the ego framework of experience with divinity that changes everything. And I'm discovering, and I know I've mentioned this before, but it's just so acute in my consciousness right now, that when that inner marriage happens, you have to have an external marriage worthy of that reflection. An exquisite union. It's just the law. The law of the universe that it must be reflected in that way. And so I take such hope and joy from that idea, because we can tend to the inner marriage in meaningful ways, knowing that the reflection in the external world has to respond. So I just love that idea. And again, same idea with wealth. Touching that will absolutely reflect in the external world, in the experience of riches. However we define that, we all define that a little bit differently. You know, we all defined a marriage a little bit differently. It could be with a partner. It could be with a creative project. It could be with a business. It could be a combination of all of those things. And riches, maybe for you, that is the flexibility of your own work schedule, or, you know, certain rhythms to your vacations each year, or a certain amount of money. Of course, that certainly fits into it, and that's appropriate. All of those things. But instead of chasing those ideals along the horizontal line of personality and the external world, to drop into the vertical, mythical space and hear how they can spontaneously and beautifully arrive in a sense of totality, not in a sense of suffering at having to achieve something externally and sort of work hard externally to get there. It's just spontaneous spring and well. I love that idea of focusing there, and the once and future king and the once and future queen. But I would like to situate the story itself, because different parts of the story will speak to you at different times and even from day to day. That is as it should be, because that's the power of myth and the power of the present moment. The archetypes that are alive right then for you will leap out. And so I want to discuss a bit of the actual story itself. And I found an excellent, excellent article online from an Australian journal called Quadrant. And the author of this is Mervyn Bendel. And he is very much an expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library material. If you're not familiar with that, there were Gnostic texts that were discovered in 1945, and they totally add an alternative perspective to the original scripture texts and cast a different light and a different perspective. And that could be a whole podcast series in and of itself as well. But what I want to note about that is that that was happening in 1945. And when we've talked about Oppenheimer and quantum physics and the leaps in consciousness that were happening on the horizontal timeline of space-time, so much was happening in this 1942 to 1945, 46 time frame. Like, it just blows my mind. And yet, of course, that's very intentional because we're meant to be leaping forward in our own consciousness. And I just find that so fascinating. So this author really knows a lot about this material. And this is a really long article. And it's called The Meaning of the Quest for the Holy Grail, again, by Mervyn Bendel. And you can easily access it online. I encourage you to read it because his perspective is, he has such a broad knowledge base of this. I'm going to read directly from this article in part, but again, it's a huge article and there's so much there, but I want to give him attribution. And he begins by saying, "There is a crisis moment in history. It is a time of highly destructive iconoclasm when it is demanded of Western civilization that it denounce and demean itself before a clamor of pseudo-historical and crypto-mythological accounts of the past, made up largely of wishful thinking and blatant opportunism. It is vital, therefore, to return to the truly ancient cultural wellsprings of the West and to explore and reassert their brilliant and unsurpassed intellectual, cultural, and spiritual resources. This article is an attempt to do this, exploring the Grail archetype as an example of these multifaceted riches." So he opens with what he calls the Great Mystery. "The Great Mystery, the Holy Grail, is one of the greatest mysteries in the entire history of Western civilization. It seems to have emerged almost from nowhere in the 12th century and to have been everywhere in literature and art before fading, only to surge forth again in the modern era. And while the Grail appears as a prize beyond price, right from the start, it has never been clear exactly what it is, what purpose it serves, from what shadowy realm it comes, what powers it possesses, and what exactly happens to those who seek to possess it or are possessed by it. It seems to be multidimensional. Concretely, it is conceived as a chalice, a cup, dish, or spear, but also as a precious stone, special person, or even a royal bloodline. More abstractly, it's a symbol, a goal, a presence, a deep secret, or the ultimate objective of a great mystical quest, whose completion bestows miraculous gifts on those who see the quest through to the end." Iconic and archetypal. The Holy Grail has become iconic in our civilization and is commonly taken to signify the very highest realms of human attainment. But attainment of what? Of just any difficult goals? Or of one great goal above all others? It also seems to be archetypal, to represent something embedded deeply in the collective consciousness of the West, both shaping and expressing our deepest longings and aspirations. Ultimately, it seems the tale of the Grail may be a story we tell ourselves about how our lives should be led. More specifically, it is about the power of the human imagination, the rich prizes it offers, and the great, even all-consuming demands it makes. Introducing the Grail. The Grail first appeared in recorded literary form as part of the Arthurian mythos, the immense collection of tales clustered around the figure of King Arthur and his court that emerged in the High Middle Ages. It was introduced into the mythos by the French poet and troubadour Chrétien de Troyes in Percival, the Story of the Grail, in 1180. Chrétien was a very influential figure in medieval literature who wrote several important Arthurian romances and introduced the important character of Lancelot. This article then goes on to talk about the patrons, etc., but we'll set that aside for now. Diving into the next section here, the First Grail Knight. Chrétien's prototypical Grail story concerns another new character in the mythos. This is Percival, who becomes the first of the Grail Knights, those whose lives come to be defined by the Grail quest. As the tale begins, we learn that Percival was raised in innocence and seclusion in the Welsh forests by his mother. He was all she had, and she was desperately anxious to protect him from the fate that had overtaken his father and brothers, all of whom were knights who had died in combat. Above all, she wanted him never to see a knight or even know of their existence, and so she kept him ignorant of all such things, However, one day he encountered a group of knights traveling through the woods. He was entranced at their noble stature and the beauty of their armor, thinking they were angels. Discovering their identity and their chivalric calling, he immediately realized his own noble vocation and rode off to Camelot to seek his destiny. Self-centered and awkward. Percival's mother was left weeping in despair. It is clear that Percival is very self-centered. He is also awkward and tactless. When he arrives in Camelot, seeking to be made a knight, he rides his horse directly into Arthur's company, where the tail of his mount knocks the king's hat off. Oblivious, he then compromises the cordiality of two ladies, who are then unjustly punished by their husbands. In neither case does Percival realize that he should defend them according to the conventions of chivalry. Later, when Arthur grimly describes the insult and dishonor done to Guinevere in his court by the obnoxious Red Knight, Percival is again oblivious. He is concerned only with being immediately made a knight, caring nothing for the king's dilemma or the queen's humiliation. So I want to pause here and just symbolically say, yes, we have a story going on, but to psychologically relate these figures and what's happening here, as we are seeking to find that which is seeking us, as depth is calling to depth, as our inner nature is beckoning us home, we have a very undisciplined mind, right? We all know that. And we have talked about that extensively in this podcast. And so Percival is a great example of the beginnings of that journey where we're completely at the mercy of our undisciplined mind. Our ego is all over the place and we react to everything and we don't have any sense of having honed our skills in any meaningful way. The idea of a knight being trained in all the chivalric protocol is like us transurfing and training the imagination. You know, it takes that skill set, that container for the divine to reveal herself. I think Percival is a great example in the beginning of just that undisciplined nature. And I hadn't realized until I dove into some of Robert Johnson, who is a very famous Jungian analyst, and we're going to read from some of his material today too. He has a whole book based on Percival called He, and it's an excellent book and I highly recommend it. And it's about the masculine, and it uses the Grail story and the story of Percival to flesh out ideas about what becoming a man and understanding masculine psychology is about. He notes that the seduction quality, you know, of knights where they're supposed to remain chaste is actually referring to, you know, not being seduced by the external. And I love that idea. I mean, because of all of our work with transurfing and training the imagination, I suddenly got that in a way that I never had before, because it means not being seduced or reacting to the external world in terms of level 3 and level 4. You know, you could take that completely differently if you're talking about level 2 consciousness and the work ethic place. But it means not being seduced by external appearances. It's not about, you know, being sexually chaste. And I love that idea because then I'm like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense now. So Percival doesn't have that ability yet, but he does have talent. So moving on in the article, Percival trains conscientiously and displays an enormous natural talent as he prepares to depart on his adventures. Actually, I want to expand on that just a moment because Marion Woodman, also a famous Jungian analyst, she reminds us that not everybody is seeking the Grail in their particular lifetime. And that's totally fine. It comes to us at different points in our awakening and different moments in our lives. And so not everybody has to be on this quest. And And I think it's really important to remember that. And, you know, there's a biblical phrase, don't cast pearls before swine, and that can be taken a lot of different ways. And I don't mean this in any kind of demeaning sense at all, but if you're having a conversation with somebody for whom this is just not important to them right now, and they're very much in a literal place in their life, and that's fine. And that's not our business. And that's okay. And it's beautiful. And we can relate and connect and be in unity consciousness even so. And the fact that Percival has natural talent to me suggests it was part of his destiny to be on this quest. So, you know, he was meant, and it didn't matter what his mom did, this awakened in him. And he was meant to seek this out. It was seeking him. So I just wanted to mention that. As he prepares to depart on his adventures, he is given some crucial advice. Keep your own counsel and do not ask too many questions. Remember how in the Baba Yaga stories, we had similar advice about knowing when to ask a question and when not to ask a question. And there's an importance about asking questions and asking better questions in the psyche, meaning that releases the psyche to answer us. And then there are moments when we should stop short, when we're too deeply into the mystery, and that can only be revealed to us in its proper time. So I just love this idea that that's echoed here as well about the asking of questions. Presently, he comes across Blanche Fleur, a fair maiden besieged in her castle by a nobleman seeking to force himself upon her. He routs this unwanted suitor and his minions, and he and Blanche Fleur duly fall in love and agree to marry. Later, Percival amazes all of Camelot by killing the Red Knight who had been troubling King Arthur. Taking the knight's distinctive vermilion armor, he sets out looking for further adventures. And we've talked about the alchemical colors in the past of red and black and white, and the Red Knight, killing the Red Knight and taking over the armor, to me and to folks I've read here in the literature, suggests taming the passions, you know, so you have all the passions of the human nature and giving them a focus, and definitely mentally, so with these mental disciplines. So being able to not run away with yourself and your mind not run away with itself. The Fisher King, here's a really important part of this story. The Fisher King, on his travels, Percival meets an angler by a river. This is the Fisher King, who invites him to stay at his castle, where Percival learns that his host suffers from an incurable wound. It transpires that the Fisher King belongs to a long line of protectors of the Holy Grail. However, he has suffered a wound to his groin and has been rendered virtually immobile and impotent. He is therefore incapable of carrying out his responsibilities or even of fathering a son to assume the task after him. So now we enter into a part of the story and the plot where we talk about the wasteland. And I want to say three things about the wasteland, because the condition of the king reflects externally in the fertility of the land. And the wasteland, in our conversations together in past podcasts, can sometimes refer to, one, the time when you've been in consciousness number two for quite a while and you've learned a lot and you've read a lot of books and you've gone to a lot of workshops, but it's time to move to the experiential levels of three and four, where no books can help us, where we have to travel the pathless path, as it is called. And when that happens, it can appear externally as though things break down and become barren, because the juice is not out in the external world right then, it's in the interiority. The bargain for what we will uncover inside will far eclipse anything we could ever do externally in the ways of riches and relationship. But there is a time where we must travel in that seemingly external barren space while we encounter our sovereignty, while we reunite, i.e. heal the wound of being separate from who we really are. So that's one thing to say about the wasteland. The second thing to say about the wasteland is that when that grail moment comes, we will forever know that nothing external will ever eclipse that experience because it is mystical, it is beyond words. Yet we are meant to return to a joyful experience of the external world and to enjoy the forms and enjoy the fruits of the external space that are mirroring this sovereignty and wealth and beauty and union from within. And so realizing that it's not something that we're trying to fix on the horizontal plane, you know, by finding money or relationship to fill a void. We are experiencing the reflection of all of that coming back at us because of the reflection of the grail itself, that reunification of ourselves to our sovereign state. So we realize that the fruits of the external world are the wasteland, then come into bloom. It revivifies itself. And so this is a really important theme in this greater story. The third thing I want to say about the wasteland is something I've just discovered. And that is that this whole grail legend has a prequel that I was unaware of. And John and Kathleen Matthews, who are husband and wife, they live in the UK and they do tons of scholarship on Western tradition and European tradition myths and lore and legends. And they are beautiful archetypal writers. They're so knowledgeable about this whole realm of work. And together, I think they have written like 200 books. And they just released a volume in 2019 called The Lost Book of the Grail. And it gives the story, which is actually in a poem. It's like 480 some lines of a poem. So this book is the prequel to everything I'm sharing with you today, just to get us all on the same page. And it's called The Elucidation of the Grail. And it talks about the feminine origins of the wasteland, not because the wasteland springs from the feminine, but because there was a violation of the feminine that predates this story that we're going through today. And the Matthews and this prequel talk about that poem and what it means. So it's almost like a deeper story of how the wasteland came to be, and it had to do with violating the feminine. And so next time we will touch on that as we move into the feminine figures of the Grail story, because I think that's really important. And I did not even know that that existed when I started this. So that actually doesn't surprise me, because that is the way of this, isn't it? You know, we take three steps and then, oh my gosh, then we kind of understand what we're doing. And I found that so exciting. And indeed, I'm listening to The Lost Book of the Grail on audio because Kathleen Matthews has the most amazing voice. It is exquisite. And she is so wonderful in her pronunciation of Celtic terms and all the rest of it. And it is a beautiful story. And I love the resonance of her voice. It's a gift in and of itself. So I highly recommend that if you want to find any scholarship on any of these myths or legends from the Matthews, they are excellent. And we'll be dipping in a bit to this prequel that is also talking about how the wasteland came to be. So back to the story at hand. I'll just read straight from the text here from this article regarding the wasteland. The tragic condition of the Fisher King's kingdom reflects the king's plight, and it has become infertile and a barren wasteland. All he can do is fish in the river near his castle, Corbenic, and wait for a mysterious Grail Knight who alone can heal him. Although knights travel from many lands to help, only the chosen one can effect the cure, and it seems he has not yet come. So now we're at a dinner scene with Percival. Percival, oblivious as usual, understands nothing of all of this. Later at dinner, he witnesses a strange procession through the castle. First, a young man passes carrying a bleeding lance, followed by two young attendants carrying candelabra. Then a beautiful young lady appears bearing an elaborately decorated grail, the brilliance of which easily outshines the light of the candelabra. Finally, an older lady passes carrying a silver carving platter. Percival is bemused, but he recalls the advice not to talk too much and not to ask questions. Consequently, he suppresses his curiosity and remains silent during this perplexing ritual. In the morning, Percival wakes up to find himself alone. Searching through the castle, he finds nothing but his horse saddled and the drawbridge lowered ready for his departure. He leaves, and the drawbridge is immediately raised and the castle closed to him. Bewildered, he goes on his way. Already the audience to this tale has been given an important clue about the central message that is meant to impart, but they, us, like Percival, remain mystified. So this is so in line with getting a vision or a peak moment in consciousness number 3, but yet not making it our own yet. In number 4, you know, we get a moment. Percival has a moment of seeing something grail, but he doesn't know what to do with it. He has a very undisciplined mind. And I'm amazed at how beautifully that all lines up. Next, a hag comes to court. Percival returns to Arthur's court, where he is received with great celebration. As Chrétien describes the scene, all night they reveled and the whole of the next day, until on the third day they saw a damsel approaching on a tawny mule, holding a whip in her right hand. She is grotesque and repulsive. There was never a creature so ugly, even in the bowels of hell. The hag reveals what it was that Percival witnessed at the mysterious castle dinner. It was the solemn grail procession, and the entire weird experience has been a test. Now she has but one message for Percival. He failed. He hadn't seized upon Dame Fortune when she had placed herself within reach. You entered the castle of the Fisher King and saw the bleeding lance, but it was too much effort for you to ask why that drop of blood flowed from the tip of the white shaft, and you didn't ask what rich man was served from the grail you saw. Furiously, she tells Percival that had he asked these simple questions, he himself would have been revealed as the Grail Knight, and the wounded Fisher King would have been healed and the blighted realm restored. Instead, because of his failure, ladies will lose their husbands, lands will be laid waste, and maidens will remain helpless as orphans. Many a knight will die. All these terrible troubles will occur because of you. Percival is devastated. Little could he know that a great saga would now begin that would entrance Western Europe for centuries. So she's talking about the continued wasteland, and often the question is succinctly asked, whom does the grail serve? Whom does the grail serve? And we will return to that idea. But that is sort of the magical question, meaning, you know, that we honor the sovereign state within. And only at that moment do the riches pour forth into the external space again. Only in that moment can the wasteland be restored, because we have the right order of things. Whom does this serve? This is not for me. This is for me to reunite with my sovereignty. So it's not an ego question. It's a union. It's a unity question. And that's what the hag is pointing out. Percival is not far enough along in his understanding to get that yet, to even ask that question yet. Vows, the hag, who is really a loathly lady, then addresses King Arthur and his court, telling them of a grand tournament where great honor and riches can be won. At this news, many knights vow they will leave immediately to seek their fortune and glory. But Percival is not one of them. Instead, he vows to commence a quest to find the truth of the Grail, and that from now on, nothing will distract or divert him. He sets out on his journey, leaving the story to focus on Sir Gawain and his many adventures. The next time we meet Percival in this tale is 5 years hence, and he is a wreck. So he is emboldened to take searching for the Grail seriously now. He's going to discipline himself as a knight. But his tale then, you know, goes its way for a while. We hear about other knights in the tale. We pick up his story later. A lot happens. I mean, these stories go on and on and on. But very interestingly, Chrétien, you know, the author of this, doesn't finish Percival's story. And other writers come in later and try to pick up the thread. And I'll just read here from the article. Why did this happen? Perhaps Chrétien died, or possibly he didn't know how to end the tale, or perhaps he felt he'd made his point. Whatever the explanation, the story's unfinished condition added not only to its mystery and appeal, it also invited many other writers to complete the tale, and these continuations and sequels vastly elaborated the saga and the complex conception of the Grail. So there's all these continuations, and this article goes into pages and pages beyond that. So there's a wealth of information there if you want to read it. But just to bring today to a close, because we're already past an hour and I have so much more to share, but we need to take this in manageable bites. It's so beautiful to me that this idea of the feminine just keeps resurfacing, and it's echoing back to the work that we've been doing. We indeed have been almost like knights of the round table advancing toward this series with all we've been doing over the last several months. And I find that so exciting because I didn't know that's what we were doing. And it's kind of beautiful to know that there is an inherent order that's revealing itself as we go. And that's the way of this, isn't it? We lead with the heart wisdom, we discipline the mind, and we boldly step forward. And that's such a new way to live, but it is the way of discovering that inner union. And I'm so committed to that. And that is my purpose this life. I know that. So a hint of things to come. Next time we will touch on this prequel that I have talked to you about. We'll talk a little bit more about moving from consciousness 3 to consciousness 4 in theory. I mean, obviously you can't just, you know, say that super succinctly and be done with it. It's an amazing and sovereign process. But C.G. Jung and other writers like Philip Pullman and William Blake and Robert Johnson all talk about this. And it's so amazing to me that we've been talking about this in terms of our conversations about consciousness. And as a student of Jung in the past, I've run across this moving from the 3 to the 4. And I kind of knew what that meant, but I kind of didn't. And now it seems so much clearer to me. And so we will talk about that in greater detail. And then finally, next time, you know, certainly we'll be moving into the feminine figures of the Grail and exploring them individually. But we'll couch that with some work by Robert Johnson again, who is a Jungian analyst who has many volumes out that are excellent and really accessible. If you find Jung a little daunting, Robert Johnson's writings are really great for just ordinary folks that love depth psychology and that perspective. They love Jung's work, but he makes it much more accessible for everyday reading. And I find Robert Johnson's books excellent. And he definitely centers in myth and legend too. So he's going into that beautiful vertical, timeless, spaceless axis. And that's so rich and rewarding. But I find him simpler to understand than Jung sometimes. But Robert Johnson has a beautiful passage, his volume He, where he talks about the six inner feminine figures that we meet archetypally, and that applies to all of us. And I want to share that bit of writing from Robert Johnson ahead of looking at the individual female figures in the Grail story, because I think looking at those archetypally with those six categories is really helpful. And also, I want to conclude today with another quote by Robert Johnson. And this is so beautiful. And it really speaks to the timeless quality of the Grail resurfacing at moments in history when we need it the most. And here is the conclusion of Robert Johnson's book, Transformation. And he says, "I have been touched deeply to learn that the ability to perceive the color blue is a recent acquisition for the human race. It probably developed fewer than 2,000 years ago. The word blue does not appear in the Old Testament or in Homer, who speaks of the wine dark sea, or any of the classical writings. This ability emerged slowly, and blue is still the most often missed hue in color blindness. Similarly, the musical sense of hearing harmonic structure as opposed to melodic line is probably still more recent. Harmonic music appears only in the 15th and 16th century. Is it consistent to say that a new faculty, four-dimensional consciousness, as we lamely describe it, is only now appearing for ordinary men and women in our human evolution? If this is so, it would follow that the new faculty is extremely rare, fragile when it does appear, and very easily lost. But it has made its appearance, and it is the most important issue in any intelligent life. Dr. Jung spent his old age writing about and contemplating this new evolution of man, the progression from incompleteness to wholeness, from 3 to 4. It is time for all of us to do the same." So my 30,000-foot perspective and intention is to not try to pin the feminine down, because that is impossible. And indeed, it is essential to know that the sovereign feminine is pure delight and joy and creative dynamism, source itself. And it will not be pinned down. And that is not my intention. But to talk about the Grail as the masculine discipline that is protecting something so exquisite and beautiful, giving pointers for each of us to take up the pathless path as we experience that sovereign center for ourselves in the way that is appropriate for each of us individually. That is my intention for this series. So thank you for sharing in this with me today and in the days and weeks ahead. Enjoy this beautiful autumnal season and the full moon coming up. And until next time, take good care. Thank you. Hi, everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lorigreen.net.